The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live from WRFH 101.7 FM, Radio Free Hillsdale, for the second day in a row. Last night, It was the best of times. It's the worst of times. The best of times because I'm on beautiful Hillsdale campus. Went to Christ Church yesterday, which may be the most beautiful chapel in America, or at least the equal of any chapel in America, built in recent years along a Wren model by Peter Strzok from, Mr. Strzok from Notre Dame. And it's just so fabulous. I was in there for a while. Then we did the town hall last night for classical education, k12.hillsdale.edu. I got back to my room at the Dow Center last night and had a message from Bill Broadbeck, who is the chairman emeritus of Hillsdale. He'd listened to every second of it and just loved it. And it's because Dr. Arne and Dr. O'Toole are such fabulous proponents of classical education. And if your school is struggling and you are a school board member, you might want to adopt the Hillsdale classical curriculum. And whether it's Singapore math, whether it's phonics, whatever it is, K through 12, it is a fabulous curriculum. There are 90 Hillsdale curriculum powered schools that are all public charter schools across the United States. And I hope to double it. I hope they double it within a year. And they've got a $1.25 million challenge grant. So you can go to k12.hillsdale.edu if you want to be a part of that. I don't know when they're going to put online the conversation I had with Dr. Arne, Dr. O'Toole, but it was fabulous. And thank you, Bill, for your kind words. So that's the best of times. Being in Hillsdale, they're building a grand new building, by the way, right in front of in the quad near Christ Church. But Christ Church was just, you should just drive to Hillsdale to see Christ Church. I then got home and realized the President of the United States is beyond infirm. He is truly, John Podhort says, senile. I don't think senile. I think sort of perpetually confused and incoherent. But his moments of lucidity last night was not one of them. He went on Univision and said this. Can we play cut number 23?
I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving there, et cetera. So what I'm calling for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country. I've spoken with everyone from the Saudis to the...
Stop right there. A unilateral ceasefire by Israel for 2 months while they've got however many hostages are left alive. What do you think he did to Hamas's consideration of the offer on the table that mediators had put forward? What do you think the president did yesterday when he said, I want a unilateral ceasefire? He killed the opportunity to get those hostages out before they're dead. And that is a nightmare. It's incoherent. He's incoherent. There was more incoherence in that interview. Let's play cut number 16, please.
Did you spend a lot of time thinking about what your legacy would look like?
Well, I hope the legacy is that I kept my word, that I said that the reason I was running was to help change the life of ordinary people and reduce the prospect of war. And because of Vietnam, And when I ran, I said that I was once asked, well, why I wouldn't, when I was one of 29 years old, said it must be a secret. And I said, yeah, the secret you got to ask yourself is, what are you willing to lose over? You figure out what you're willing to lose over, you got an idea what you should be doing. And so I hope my legacy is that I was honest, straightforward, and did what I said.
This makes no sense, right? Vietnam, it's like my 8-track tape of Pure Prairie League was still working. Amy, what you going to do? Vietnam, that was, by the way, 6 years after Vietnam. Vietnam, I don't know what he's talking about. Nobody knows what he's talking about.
And he looked and sounded horrible.
Cut number 17. If you're watching on the Salem News Channel, he is absolutely feeble and infirm. Cut number 17.
Have you made a final decision on taking executive order in terms of what you want to do at the border? That includes the power to shut down the border, as it was suggested.
Well, it suggested that. We're examining whether or not I have that power. I would have that power under the legislation when the border has over 500,000 people, 5,000 people a day trying to cross the border because you can't manage it, slow it up. There's no guarantee that I have that power all by myself without legislation. And some are suggesting I should just go ahead and try it. And if I get shut down by the court, I get shut down by the court. But we're trying to work through that right now.
Now, you know, you got to think that he did not wait for the court's approval on student loan forgiveness, and they rebuked him, but he did it anyway. And he's doing it again, and it's still unconstitutional. And he is just obviously making stuff up at this point. I really do think he has lost it. God save this country until January, because you can't vote for him again. I don't care if you hate Donald Trump from morning till sundown and then dream about hating Donald Trump all night long. If you care about this country, if you care about yourself, your children, your grandchildren, their children, you've just got to vote for Donald Trump. It's pretty much a nightmare. Let me run some other headlines. We've got Iran's supreme leader, Khamenei, says Tehran will retaliate for Israel's alleged bombing of a consulate. And Israel said, we'll hit you right back in Tehran, buddy. And do not screw around with Netanyahu, Gantz, and Dermer in the war cabinet. Just don't even try it. We've gotten the Telegraph that confirmation of all. The whole world knows that Joe Biden has lost it. They're confirming. Boy, that was a weird interview he gave to Univision. There is in the Wall Street Journal a warning about China. And if you have China mutual funds, get out. Fitch has cut the outlook on the fiscal strain in China, citing their growth risks. 40 minutes ago that came out. And when Fitch cuts you, you're in trouble. There's also a real estate nightmare unfolding in downtown St. Louis as the doom loop engulfs the gateway city. Arizona Supreme Court revived the 160-year-old law, which had been put on hold by Roe v. Wade. It outlaws all abortions except those that save the life of the mother. And that is not... It's on the front page of every legacy media because they're trying to make abortion, not Joe Biden, the issue in the fall. But that's not going to work because the states will work it out. They'll figure out what their people want. There will be initiatives in some places. There'll be legislatures. And if Arizona doesn't want to allow abortions except to save the life of the mother, that's up to Arizona. I agree with Donald Trump on this. The Iranian attack from Israel on its own soil rather than via proxy groups would invite an Israeli retaliation in kind, Foreign Minister Katz said on X. Quote, if Iran attacks from its own territory, Israel will respond to the attack in Iran. There is also a story today that the second parent of the Michigan shooter, Ethan Crumley, has been sentenced to 10 to 15 years. And in Ellis Items, which you should read every single morning, it's the Substack I read last before... It turns out that the contours of the 2024 political landscape are evenly divided, with about half of all registered voters, 49% are Democrats or lean to the Democratic Party, 48% identify as Republicans or lean Republicans. Quote, in recent decades, neither party has had a sizable advantage, but the Democratic Party has lost the edge it maintained from 2017 to 2021. That is really something else, because half of homeowners and renters are sometimes regularly or greatly struggling to afford their housing payments. Thank you, Joe Biden. And the hack judge in New York has refused to delay Donald Trump's trial. And one appeals court judge, another hack judge in New York, they're all hack judges up there, I think, did the same thing. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. I'm waiting for Mike Rogers to be the senator here so I can complain about the roads. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and I'm in a good mood. Even though I've been in a bad mood for the first two segments, I'm in a good mood because I have the two outstanding seniors of Hillsdale College joining me right now. Rebecca Hendricks, and I've got Benjamin Hendricks and Rebecca and Helen Schlatter. Can I get any more wrong? Helen Schlatter and Benjamin Hendricks, welcome to you both. You're the outstanding seniors, and you're both Germans. I love that. You both took German in school. Say a little German for us, if you wouldn't mind, Helen.
Hallo.
Hello. How about you?
Hallo, Hugh. Wie geht's? Wie geht's in die States?
In die States. Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I haven't ever learned any German. Both of my brothers who were ahead of me in college took German and flunked it at Oberlin and Harvard. So I took Introduction to Latin and got an A because I knew how to work the system. But you guys actually took German and did well. My mother's maiden name is Rohl, R-O-H-L, and my grandfather was the last man in America named Adolf because he was born in 1892 when it was still an acceptable name. So let's get your stories down. I'll start with you, Helen. What did you major in? Where did you come from? Where are you going?
Great question, and thank you so much for having me. So I am currently a senior at Hillsdale College, and I am studying philosophy, which I was actually born in. I was born in Iowa, and I was actually grew up in Hillsdale for the first, I think it's been 16 years now, because my father teaches philosophy at the college.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
No pressure.
No pressure. So when I was in high school, I thought that philosophy was the last thing that I was going to major in. And I thought, you know, I don't want to go to Hillsdale. I don't want to have 13th grade. And I didn't know much when I was a senior in high school, but I knew that I wanted a place where there's strong academics and challenging classes and friendships, real friendships with my peers. And so I visited for a leaders weekend in February of my senior year, and was blown away by the classes and was blown away by my visiting peers, and thought, this is the place I want to be at. So,
and I can avoid my dad on campus.
Exactly. Well, yes, I actually haven't. I've taken several of his classes at this point and love them and truly love them, even though I'm biased, of course. So I got to Hillsdale and realized that all of the reasons that I loved this, my specific classes, was ultimately because I loved philosophy, and that all of my questions that were coming up in physics and English were philosophical questions. And so I like to think that I'm, you know, majoring in everything in some ways. So I decided to major in philosophy. And during an ethical theory class, I decided that my particular interest is in the humanities, the intersection of humanities and philosophy specifically. And so I am going to be in D.C. in next year working at a public policy think tank.
Which one? Ethics.
It's the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
Oh, very, very excellent. Ryan Anderson is one of the great men of Washington, D.C., and it's a fabulous place to be. I'll see you inside the Beltway. Welcome to the Beltway. Take your time up here because it gets grimy and gross down there. Let me turn to Benjamin Hendricks. Ben, tell me where you are from. I know where you're from, but tell the audience where you're from and how you ended up here and what your experience has been.
So I'm from Escondido, California.
That's a far par away.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a beautiful town. I love it. And the way that I found Hillsdale, though, is my father is a great books teacher for homeschoolers. He's not part of any academic organization. They pay him and he teaches them the most important things. So it's sort of like a, you know, a probably group of like 30 or 40 students that he'll talk to at a time, and it'll be for high schoolers. So that's something that's been really helpful for my life and the life of my siblings. But he has had a lot of students who've come to Hillsdale and really loved it. And it was so far away. I thought I'd never want to go to school, you know, thousands of miles away from my home. And then I said, you know what, at least I'll apply, I'll go visit, I'll see what it's about. And the other schools I'd been at were, and they seemed like they would be enjoyable, they seemed like they would push me in some ways. But when I came to Hillsdale, I realized that there were two things that set it apart. Number one, it's going to push me harder than any school I could have gone to. And the second other thing is the community of Hillsdale was really incredible. It seemed like people supported each other in a much more rigorous and real way than they could have possibly done at other schools. It was a knocking down of the facade that you'll see a lot of times that people put up when socializing with each other, because they all know why they're here. They all know that everyone else at the school is a nerd in some ways, in the good ways. And through that, you're going to be able to have these more intellectual conversations. You're going to be able to talk about the most important things.
Now, do you go by Ben or Benjamin?
I really haven't decided, and that's a problem because most of the time people have decided that by this point in life. But I feel like it's just the context, you know.
Yeah, my son went from Jamie to James when he went to DC. Because no way. So you'll have to figure it out. But you are a big man. People can't see that. You're a big man. You're a football player. Mm-hmm. How do the are you the Chargers?
Yeah, we're the Chargers.
And so how did the Chargers do in your 4 years, and what position? Are you a tight end?
Yeah.
I could have guessed it. See, no. I'm not bad at this. How were they over your 4 years? Because they're a pretty good club.
Yeah, yeah. So over my 4 years, we really struggled through a lot of adversity and were able to ultimately come out with some success in the end. And, you know, there's nothing that I've been prouder to be part of on campus or really in my life than the Hillsdale Charger football organization, just because of the fact that it's full of people who are at one of the hardest schools in America. They're playing the hardest sport. They are putting themselves up against someone else every single day. They're putting themselves, whether it's another team or whether it's your teammates in practice, you are competing in a way that is so much more physical, so much more direct than any sort of other sport or intellectual competition, but you still love each other, even though you're competing against them.
You know, I've looked at both of your list of things, and Helen, you've been on the Dean's List forever, Phi Beta Kappa, Phi Sigma Tau, Chamber Choir, Soprano. By the way, I was in your chapel yesterday. Have you sung in that chapel?
Oh, yes.
What are the acoustics in that place?
It's amazing. It is. We have to actually, when we're singing choral pieces, we're doing an Elijah performance by Mendelssohn this weekend, and you have to.
Oh,
actually,
of course you are.
it's going to be amazing, but we have to actually shorten our consonants and our vowels because of the resonance in the chapel is so.
I would have guessed that right away. No, how many people turn out for the chapel choir?
We've had a good chunk at our performances. I would say probably the largest is about 500.
Yeah, young mister, I got to make sure I get his name correct. That I want to get his name. He took me on a tour of it yesterday, and it was the best person to take me on the tour, Mr. Stanish.
Yes.
And, do you know Mr. Stanish?
Yes.
And
yeah.
Is it Robert?
Yeah. Nathan.
Nathan. And so Nathan he's played the organ before. There are two organs.
Yeah.
And he said, that's the chapel choir. They're the real singers. So how many hours a week did you sing as opposed to do philosophy?
I'm in choir. Mondays and Wednesdays from 3 to 5:45. So a good chunk. And I love it.
And Ben, you also did Journal Buddies Elementary Outreach. What is that, an elementary outreach?
Yeah. So that's something that the football team does, where we will go to Guyer Elementary and we'll all put on suits, and we'll go probably once every 2 weeks, and we'll all put on suits. We'll go to the elementary school, and it's called Guys with Tie. Oh, sorry. I'm so dumb. No, I was talking about this other thing. It was it's called Guys with Ties.
We'll go with Guys with Ties.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what that is there are all these little boys, and they wear suits and ties too, and we teach them how to put on a tie, how to have good manners, how to just be kind and proper. And so that's
these big football players are in there with these little boys.
Yes, it's awesome.
That is good.
It's been one of my favorite things at Hillsdale.
I'm going to resident assistant. So you have to deal. I'm talking now with Helen. You have to deal with the freshmen. And how is their transition from the broader world? Because some people come from Escondido. Some people come from Hillsdale. Some people come from the east, the west, the south, the north, the Hillsdale. You've got, I think, 1,400 students here. How is that?
Yeah. So I was an RA my sophomore year, and Hillsdale is a little different in that there's two, at least when I was a sophomore, there's two main freshman dorms, and then there's a mix of upperclassmen, sophomore to seniors. So sadly, my dorm wasn't the freshman-specific dorm. It was the mixed dorm. But because the RAs work in teams across campus and have an amazing culture, you'll generally be engaging with the freshmen all the time. And what is it like working with freshmen? It's super fun. A lot of them are just so excited to be in classes. It's very fun to mentor them.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Bob Rosenfeld was my freshman RA at Harvard in 1974. He was the managing editor of the Harvard Law Review, and I remember him distinctly. He practices in, I believe, Fort Wayne. People never forget their freshman RA, either good or bad. Bob was good, but I'm just warning you, you'll be running into people that you do not remember. And so be ready for that. What is the student ambassador? Oh, you did Shakespeare.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually one of the most fun things that I've done at Hillsdale. This is a completely student-led organization, and they throw together a Shakespeare show in the last 2 months. My friend Kylie is doing it right now.
Throw together.
Well, there's some good practices, but it's informal. So it happens in the Arb, the Arboretum, which is a beautiful garden. And we have a bunch of families in the community come and they lay out picnic
blankets.
What'd
you do this year?
This year, they are doing Much Ado About Nothing.
All right. Very, very good. I'm going to go back to you. Football Bible study leader. How many members, Ben, are on your football Bible study? How many people participate?
Between 10 and 20. And so that's something that I've really enjoyed because it just lets you open up to each other, lets you talk about, you know, how to live a Christian life. And we'll either go through it topic-based or we'll go through a certain book of the Bible. And so that's been something that's been very helpful, very important for, you know, I feel
so
like.
So I got to ask, because everyone's like, what are you two going to do after? What is the objective of the life? I don't know what your job is. She's going to Ethics and Public Policy Center, where they got Ed Whalen and Ryan Anderson, and they got amazing people there. Where are you going next year?
Yeah, so I'm most likely getting a Master's of Economics at UT Austin. And so that's
quite the vibe change from Hillsdale.
I know. It's nice, though, because I feel like it's a 10-month program, and it just teaches you a lot of skills. It's going to be, you know, pretty good. And so after that, though, I want to, you know, interact more with people that I've gotten to know at Hillsdale, because there's such a great network here, and find a job in economic consulting, or, you know, just see what is most interesting to me in this.
Well, if I was recruiting for anyone, anywhere, I would have someone planted on this campus. So good luck in Austin. Good luck in Washington, D.C. If I can be of help to you inside the Beltway, let me know. Helen, Ben, thank you for being my even though I botched your names at the beginning, I'm sorry, but you guys are terrific guests. Go Chargers, and thank you for joining me. I'll be right back, America. From Hillsdale, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm at Radio Free Hillsdale, 101.7 WRFH. I'm sitting up straight because the Associate Dean of Men is here. And Dean Jeffrey Rogers is here. They say your nickname is Chief.
Yes, sir.
And everybody calls you. I'm going to call you Dean.
All right.
Because I am a visitor. But why does everyone call you Chief?
Well, I was in the Navy, and I was a chief hospital corpsman. I like it because the Apostle Paul used it. He said, this is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptation that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners among I am chief. So it's a debasing term. It reminds me, I'm not all that.
That is wonderful.
So, yeah.
And when did you pick up chief?
I picked it up in 2009.
Okay. So you've been here since 2011, so you picked it up in the Navy. What'd you do in the Navy as corpsman? Where'd you go? Everywhere?
Yes, I was stationed in Iceland. That's where I got my tan at. 6 months of darkness and light. And then I was stationed in Japan. I was in Yokosuka. I was over in the Middle East and spent some time in the desert. We were in Australia a little bit.
Navy corpsman goes out with the Marines, don't you?
Yes, sir.
And so you've deployed with the Marines?
Yes, sir.
When I do the Semper Fi Fun show, which we do on Veterans Day and Memorial Day every year, I often get a Navy corpsman who has himself been injured tending to the injured. So I'm sure you saw a lot of interesting things in our 20 years of war, which is coincident with your Navy career, correct?
Yes, sir.
Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yes, sir.
So there aren't going to be many kids around here who give you trouble, are there?
No.
No. Now, you get a lot of kids coming into the military from here.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, I think when our kids study the U.S. Constitution, they understand that our freedoms are given to us by God, not by the government. But we want to keep America free and allow our citizenry to enjoy life and liberty and a pursuit of happiness. And once kids get a hold of what that means, they want to Roger up and make that happen.
Now, Dean Roger, Chief, wherever young men are gathered, young men will do young men things.
Yes.
And they're not usually bright when they're collected. They're bright. Like, I just talked to a very bright guy, but I'm sure he's had his mom. So do you have to knock on the door of the fraternity house or wherever they're living? Because I guess only about 20% of your men are in fraternities. What's your job?
Yeah, so I kind of make the statement that Walmart, Target, you know, they should get rid of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion and have the Office of the Dean of Men. so that we can tell young men being a man is a good thing. So, yes, there are times I need to knock on the fraternity doors or even in a dorm and just remind young men that boys go through life saying, what do I want to do? Men go through life saying, what do I need to do? But we try to move them to a third tier, godly men, and say, what does he want me to do? And so that's a process. And we calibrate young men. We will admit Peter Pan, but he has to burn the green tights, make a commitment to Tinkerbell, and he can't be living on proverbial clouds.
Amen to all of that. Now, yes, when college boys seek the company of college girls, sometimes their manners fail. Is that where the chief comes in as well?
Yes, yes. Chivalry is not dead here. Our young ladies here have really thick quads because the guys open a lot of doors here. And we got them to about 400 meters. We're trying to shorten that gap.
So yeah, well, that's very good. So, now, what do you like the most about the school? You could have gone anywhere because you're 26 years in the Navy. How long? So you could have gone anywhere. What brought you to Hillsdale?
Well, I learned about the college's rich history. And Frederick Douglass came here and spoke twice
at
Hillsdale, invited by Women's Auxiliary Group to come and speak. This was an abolitionist college. It's a faith-filled college. It was founded by Free Will Baptists. And I was stationed in Charleston, and I used to live in the South, and we have this statement. It goes like this. I learned this in the South. If it's new, it probably isn't true. We've been doing this for 180 years, Hugh, and we're not changing course. We have a trajectory. It's true north. And I fell in love with that mission. And I always wanted to speak to the future. And what a great place to do it at. These young men, and you've had a couple of young folks here. These people are our future. And to be able to work with them and come alongside
them. They stay in touch with you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I keep in touch with a lot.
Now you have one problem.
Yes.
His name is Arn.
Yeah.
Do you have rights over at Broadlawn? Do you get to corral him? Because he's awfully mean to me. You could teach him some manners.
Right. No, Dr. Arn's a good man.
How big of a team do you have? We got a minute left. How big is the administrative team to sort of help guide the young men and young women towards being fully developed men and women?
Right. So we have, I'm the associate dean of men. That's the dean of men, Aaron Peterson. We have two deans of women as well. And we have a vice president, Diane Phillip. And then we have a whole cast of characters. We hire all the RAs. We can't do this ourselves. We hire capable young men and women to work alongside us.
And they're your RAs, and you gather them together, and you tell them how to lead?
Yes.
That's a great thing. You're probably as responsible as any of their professors for how they come out of here. Dean Rogers, thank you for joining me this morning.
Continue
on in your success at Hillsdale. Bet you brought a lot of people to the school today with just that affirmation of your faith and your service, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
I'll be right back. Hour number two, straight ahead from Hillsdale. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Morning glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Hugh Hewitt broadcasting today from WRFH 101.7 Radio Free Hillsdale. And the man who makes it all happen here is Scott Bertram. I say that because he phonetically spelled it out Burrtram, Bertram. Why did you do that? How do people mispronounce Bertram?
Generally, I get Bertram, but Bertram. Bertram.
Well, then you should have capitalized the T-R-A-M instead of the Burr.
But the emphasis is on the first syllable.
Bertram. Okay, Bertram. Well, Scott Bertram is the general manager of WRFH, Free Hillsdale, Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7. He lectures in journalism here. I was teaching your class yesterday.
Yes.
Smart kids, by the way.
Great kids.
He is the director of the Hillsdale Podcast Network, Where do people find the Hillsdale Podcast Network?
They can find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu, which is the main site, but also anywhere they find audio. So Apple Podcasts and Spotify, we're in all those places too.
You also host the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Is that daily, weekly? How often?
That's a weekend show. It's a terrestrial show. So on radio stations, we're on 42 affiliates across the country on various times over the weekend. And that's also available as a podcast on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network.
And Dwayne, though he is a White Sox fan, we have discovered that he is willing to guest host occasionally. You guest host for people around Michigan, so we might drag you in. Whenever we find someone who can do guest hosting, we put their name down on the list. So who do you guest host for?
I guest host for a guy named Steve Gruber, who has a show that's at about 30 affiliates across Michigan. Michigan's a neat media state because it's a peninsula, so you don't have the penetration from surrounding states. So it's a little insular as a media sort of state. As a media,
do they have
a market.
Uper station?
Yeah, they're on a bunch of stations up in the Upper Peninsula.
Can you speak Uper?
I can't.
Okay, so you have no idea. Do you get a translator to do that? So,
I need a translator.
Scott, what brought you to Hillsdale? What was that? You were a radio guy. You are a radio guy. Yes. You know radio inside and out. I've known you from a long time from your previous life. How did you end up here?
Always wanted to do radio. Only thing I ever wanted to do in my life, quite frankly. And one of my first words was radio. So it was meant to be. And I was worked in Chicago, worked in sports radio in Chicago, worked in news talk radio up in Rockford, Illinois. And was not looking for a job change at that point, and saw that John Miller, who was on the show yesterday, he's the head of the Dow Journalism Department here at Hillsdale, also writes at National Review. And at the corner at National Review, where it's a little back and forth between the writers, he had posted this job opportunity here at Hillsdale to be the first general manager of the radio station here at Hillsdale and build the radio and audio program at the college. And I knew about the college thanks to advertising on your show and other shows. So I knew about its reputation and what it stood for. And the light bulb went off and said, if I were to leave this job, this would be the job to leave for. This would be a really great fit for me. And so came up, met everybody, obviously loved the college, loved the people. It just worked out perfectly.
Now, Scott, you've got the equal of any studio I've worked out of. The technology is 5-star. The reception is terrific. The quality control is terrific. And you're teaching kids how to communicate. Do any of them say to you, but radio's going away?
I hear that occasionally from students. And it is absolutely a worry that, you know, for a long time.
30 years from now.
Right. We've said, you know, young people don't listen to news talk, but they'll age into it. So the question is, young people perhaps don't listen to the radio, but will they age into it when they begin driving, when they're going from place to place, commuting? I think there's still some question about that. But the beautiful thing is, with audio, there is this insatiable appetite for it, for that intimate connection that you can make with someone via audio. There's no visuals, there's no chyrons, all you are doing is communicating with your voice. And particularly these days, with the way people listen on their mobile devices and sticking little earbuds in their ears, if you're hosting, you're literally inside someone's head.
Yeah.
Sometimes whispering for effect. And that
not like Joe Biden.
No. But it's such an intimate connection. And the rise of podcasting and the popularity of podcasting, I think, speaks to this desire inside all of us to have that connection. So radio is here. Radio is successful. Radio will continue to be successful for years. I don't see it dropping off a cliff as, say, the print industry has revenue wise and with some of the jobs. Certainly radio has its problems, but this sort of side branch of podcasting and the ability to connect with people via their mobile devices, wherever they are, in the car, gardening. It has some of the same magic and power of radio. It's portable. You take it with you and you have that connection.
You know, I was talking to your chairman emeritus, Bill Broadbeck, a couple of nights ago. He listens every day.
Every day.
He listens for 3 hours. And Bill, thank you for your kind message last night. He leans in to radio, and many people do. I discover as we go around the country, and Dr. Arn has found this too, people listen to the Hillsdale Dialogue every week. When you're teaching the elements of radio, you stress before, during, and after storytelling.
Yes.
And I love that part because a lot of people don't get that. You've got to be able to weave a tale and bring people, whether you're on the Pennsylvania Turnpike driving as I was, you've got to get them into the mountains of Pennsylvania with the truckers on the curb. You got to take them there, and it's all up to your voice, et cetera. So how long does it take you to teach them how to do that?
Well, if I have the ability to work with a student over the course of a full year. So fall term and spring term. And we do air checks. We talk about, you know, before anybody gets on the air here, before anyone starts anything, we have this intake form. There's this system. So we talk about, what is your mission statement? What do you want to accomplish with this? How are you going to use the time? We go over rundowns. How are you going to begin? How are you going to welcome people in? How do you grab their attention? How do you keep them through the 22 minutes or 44 minutes or however long you want to talk with them? And then part of the class and part of what we do is the techniques of doing that. So I would say if I have a full year, student starts as a sophomore and I have their sophomore year to work with them, by junior year, they have a good idea about how to do it. And then it's a matter of execution, repeating it and doing it over and over again.
Well, you've got to get reps in.
Absolutely.
You've got to do the reps. I did not talk about demographic targeting yesterday, about how one could either aim for 10 to 15, 15 to 20, whatever it is. Do you do all that? You're talking about how you target an audience. You just can't say, I'm going to talk to the world, because yes, the world isn't going to listen to you.
Yes. I don't recommend, I mean, I don't say you have to talk to this particular demographic, but of utmost importance is knowing who you are talking to, knowing who your audience is. So I tell the story and you echoed. And by the way, it's always great when you say things that I've been saying in the classroom, because, you know,
yeah,
helps. It's good to get that. Absolutely. So I tell, you know, when I was hosting a news talk show in Rockford, Illinois, I had a picture of the person I was talking to every morning. It was a man, the age of 52 years old, married, high, you know, upper income,
or children,
you know,
in the house,
class, children in the house, one in college, one in high school, one in seventh or eighth grade, still making mortgage payments, commuting to work every day. You have to know, you know, wants, needs, desires of that sort of person. So, you know, whether they're targeting that person or going into a talk show and they want to target that kind of person, or they're targeting their age bracket, 18 to 24 year olds, you still have to get inside the head and think about what that particular listener wants from an audio product, from a radio
show. So I mentioned to your class yesterday, Mr. Beast, who is the 9-year-old my Flash has told me about, and all of them knew who Mr. Beast was. And so this is the penetration of online media into our forum. And it's fine, because Mr. Beast can't do radio. Mr. Beast's got to do video, because that's what they want to watch. Are they smitten with the idea of becoming so-called influencers, unaware of the pitfalls of doing so?
I don't hear a lot about that. I honestly don't. There are, you know, occasionally, you know, I concentrate on spoken word and audio. So I don't talk a lot about sort of bringing in the video element. We can if they want to, but I think that what we concentrate on here is the ability to communicate, the art of rhetoric, and as you pointed out earlier, the art of storytelling as well. Those are the things that I concentrate on. And I honestly haven't had, I maybe count on one hand the number of conversations over the past 8 years with students who are talking about being an influencer or having a significant YouTube presence. That's not something that particularly our students end up interested in.
There is no major in journalism in Hillsdale. There is a minor,
right,
which I approve of heartily. Because if you're majoring in journalism, you're setting sail on a ship that's going to go over 9 out of 10 and aren't going to make it to the new world. And if you have a minor, however, you will know how to communicate in any setting. Do they believe you when you tell them that?
Yes. Yes. I think it's a selling point for our program. We want you, if you're interested in journalism, to learn by doing journalism. Come to Hillsdale, write for the Collegian. Come to Hillsdale, work for the radio station, do a show, have a podcast, get an internship, make connections. We want you to do the work, because you will learn journalism by doing the work. And as you're here at Hillsdale, pick a major. If you want to be an economics reporter down the road, major in economics, minor in journalism. That's kind of the best combination you can come up with.
You know, it was fascinating. You had that Englishman in your class yesterday.
Yes.
And I thought, this is really a cross-section. I used to say it's a cross-section of the United States. Now it's a cross-section of the world. And they all want to know the spoken word.
Yes.
Scott Bertram, thank you for being with us. We didn't even talk about this guy. Why does Dwayne hate this man so much?
There's no reason to hate A.J. Brzezinski. I'm not sure what Dwayne's problem is.
I don't know what it is, but it set him off. And I don't know why
he's
we're talking about
it. Incarnate.
Let's see. Oh, the Angels' bitterness. The Angels' bitterness. It said 2011 you won?
2005.
Oh, hang on to it.
Yeah.
Hang on to it, because
you got to make that last for a while.
It's going to have to, for the tribe, it's been since 1948. So hang on to that. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back from Hillsdale. Thank you, Scott. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, broadcasting from Hillsdale today. Lauren Washburn and Lauren Smith and Logan Washburn are my guests right now. Two more Hillsdale students and terrific students they are, but I want to be very clear from the beginning. Logan is marrying a Lauren, but not this Lauren after college this year. So I want to make sure that you know they're friends, but they are not getting married. The other Lauren is not here this morning. Let me start with you, Lauren. You're the junior. It says you're from Jackson, but you're not really from Jackson, Michigan. You're a Vegas girl.
I'm not originally from Jackson, although to be fair, I only spent about 6 months in Las Vegas before I moved. I was actually a military brat, so my parents were both Air Force.
Which, sir? Are they Air Force?
Yep.
Okay, and where have you lived in your long and military life? Because I have grandchildren who are military kids.
Quite a few different places, from the East Coast to the West Coast, and then my only overseas assignment with them was Belgium.
And did you have fun being a military brat?
Had a lot of fun. Yeah. It was stressful and hard to pick up and move every so often, but it was just so fun to see all the new places, and you get to make friends really fast.
Resilience. Resilience matters a lot. You are a novelist. I find this to be amazing. When did you decide to become a novelist? What is your name under which you write? And I think you write under Smith with a Y. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's
correct. And what kind of novels are you writing?
So I write mostly young adult books, and I got into it because I just loved to read as a kid. I was homeschooled, so I had lots of time for that kind of thing, and that was a big focus of my education. And as I started reading, I eventually kind of ran out of novels that were really intensely adventurous, but were still appropriate for my age group. And so I was like, well, if I can't find what I'm looking for, then maybe I should just write it myself. And so I got started doing that. I wrote a couple of, you know, books, handwritten in the backs of notebooks and things like this. And then eventually I typed one up. I was inspired to write about actually the end times, which is kind of a big topic for a 13-year-old to tackle. But I did it and ended up sending it off to a publisher and getting it published when I was 13, 14. So that's how I got started. And I've written two more
since. I cannot wait to tell my granddaughter, who is an aspiring novelist, that you started at 13. She's not 13 yet. So where do people buy your books?
They can buy them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or I have a website, laurensmithbooks.com. And you're right, that's Smith with a Y.
Laurensmithbooks.com. Yes. Logan, let's talk about you. Where are you from?
I'm from Redmond, Oregon.
Okay, so how do you end up here from Oregon?
Well, my grandparents subscribed to Imprimis, the magazine. And since my early teen years, 13, I was interested in politics, current events, and things like that. And so I began to read that. And I realized that Hillsdale completely lined up with my entire passion and the direction of my education. I've always loved history and the Constitution. Like, even when I was in elementary school, I just thought it was a very literal thing. It made sense that if you read the Constitution, it should mean what it says. And Hillsdale's educational mission really lines up with that in a very logical way.
You know, I've often said, I've taught con law since 1996, the Constitution is not hard. It was written by farmers, for farmers, and voted on by farmers. And so just read it, and you'll have a good place to start. If it ain't in there, it's a police power. It's left to the states, which is why I'm okay with Dobbs. I thought Dobbs was long overdue. Let me ask you, you're going to work for Molly. I should say you're going to work for the Federalist. How and what are you going to do?
So I'm going to be an elections reporter. I'm going to be a staff writer covering election integrity issues in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Oh, my goodness. You're going to have a lot of work to do.
I think so.
Have they fixed any of the Molly's book Rigged is must reading for everyone. And it's not about cheating. It's about rigging, which is different. And are you prepared to cover all the intricacies of electioneering?
Absolutely. I mean, they're doing a great job preparing for that. And I've been doing that kind of in the freelance world for a while now. And there are a lot of dark money groups shuttling different funds around and setting up pop-up groups to expand the Democratic voter base. And that's where I think a lot of the concern is coming from.
Has either Michigan or Wisconsin banned Zuckerbucks?
No, not yet.
So they can still come here and influence the election?
I believe so. Actually, in Wisconsin, let me take that back. I'm not sure. But in Michigan, we haven't.
You are an investigative reporter for the Collegian.
I am.
And what did you investigate for the Collegian? Hopefully not me, not Scott, not anyone involving the radio station.
No, no one here. Yeah, a lot of local projects. There's a hotel project going on downtown currently that I've been doing some work on. Everyone's optimistic about it. But one of the larger pieces was also about wind turbines in the area, how it affects local landowners, local townships, and the state government here in Michigan recently took away communities' ability to say no to these projects.
And so how did you learn to write?
I really don't know fully. It wasn't like a class I took. It's all just practice. In journalism, you learn by doing. So I began writing for the Collegian, and I feel bad for my initial editors because my writing was not good.
Well, I tell all college students they should work for their college newspaper or radio station because the skill sets are great. You are also a journalism minor, are you not, lawyer?
Yes, Warren? That's right.
And so why did you say I'll do a minor in journalism? What's your major, by the way?
My major is economics.
That's right. Okay.
So I'll start with the major. I chose economics as a major because I felt like if I was going to be a really good writer, I needed to have something to write about. I didn't just want to know how to write by itself. I didn't feel like that would be the most useful. So, but then my main interest was always writing. I had already, like I said, I had already written books. I had already written lots of articles, and I knew I wanted to get better at that skill set too. So journalism seemed like the obvious choice.
Do you want to stay in young adult fiction? Because it's a booming, booming area.
I do. Yes.
Brett Baer just put out his first young adult novel, The History Twisters. I would recommend it to you because he's doing something that was rather routine when I was 10 years younger than you. Put real history with a lot of fiction into a book for a young adult anywhere from 8 to 18. And it really does change their ability to enjoy other than dross. What do you make of graphic novels?
I think graphic novels are interesting. I have no skill in the arts whatsoever, so they're never something that I would necessarily make myself, but I do think they're a good way for people who really need that visual element added to books. I think it's a good way to get them into reading.
And are your three novels of a piece, are they a series or are they each different?
They're all independent of each other.
Are you going to pick up and create someone who becomes like Mr. Captain Underpants or something like that, that becomes a gazillion seller?
You know, I should do that. It might be the profitable way to do it. But so far, I've been able to fit all of my stories into a couple hundred pages. Hard to expand out from there.
All right. So you're marrying a Lauren Logan. What is she going? Is she an undergraduate? Is she going to stay in school or is she going to be done?
She's going to be graduating as well.
And so you both want to stay in Michigan?
Yeah, we do.
So unfortunately, no college football up here.
Oh, no, none at all. There's no competition whatsoever.
They actually got themselves a national title this year. I have to acknowledge that. For all, I went to the law school there, but I'm an Ohio State fan. Looking forward to talking to my next guest. When you pick writing for Molly and going down to the Federalist, did you have other things in mind? Did you think you would have to stay in Michigan, find a job for the Free Press or something like that? Or was it the Federalist that drew you to journalism?
I mean, really, I've been drawn to journalism since I've been working for the Collegian. And since being in the town of Hillsdale, going to school here, I've really fallen in love with the smaller town way of life. And having friends in the area makes it a lot more appealing when you're getting married and you want to start out with a stable life where you can spend time with your spouse. And so that's something that was really appealing about that.
Now, are you committed to this as a career? Because of the whole field, I taught the elements of a talk show yesterday, and I had to warn them. The whole field is changing so rapidly and so quickly. A lot of very fine reporters, suddenly, they're not working the next day. It's got nothing to do with them. Their work is great, but the money runs out. Are you prepared for that kind of turbulence?
I think, yeah, that's a great question. I'm definitely prepared for that. The good thing about journalism is that it's very flexible. So if one job doesn't work out, suddenly you can be somewhere else because they really value experience. And a lot of these issues you only learn about by reporting on
them. Yeah, one of the very best reporters in America, who's no longer a reporter, is Ron Fournier. And he lives in Detroit. You ought to look him up. Who's been your mentor, Lauren? Anyone teach you about novels? Do they have a novel writing class here?
I haven't taken a novel writing class here. I would say one of the classes that was most influential on my writing specifically was a class on George Orwell that was taught by John J. Miller. You know, George Orwell's prose is just fantastic. The way he writes about really difficult topics and yet you're still laughing the whole time, that's a skill that I would love to cultivate.
Now, tell me about the Grammar Minute. You've won lots of awards and you do the Grammar Minute, which I am a huge fan of. And if you'll do one on not saying me and Logan, so I can send it to my sons, I would love that. But what is the Grammar Minute?
Yeah, so the Grammar Minute is a 60-second writing show, and I just take, you know, one topic. Me and is a great example of something I would do. Fewer versus less is a personal pet peeve, But I just take that and I explain it in sort of a humorous and entertaining way. It's super short. It's super quick. It just focuses on the essentials so you can learn to write.
Is it in syndication yet?
It is not yet, but that's my summer project.
Because that would fit on the weekend in a lot of radio shows where they're looking for 1 minute fills between news, traffic and sports and the beginning of a weekend, which isn't necessarily 22 minutes. Are you doing any spoken word, Logan?
I'm not. I do sometimes come in as a guest on my fiance's radio show.
Oh, what's her radio show?
Her radio show. Well, she does Great Men Back Then. I don't go as a guest on that, but she and some of her friends do a show called Sidebar, where they analyze funny news stories from the last week. And it's
oh, that's like
time.
Dwayne does a whole after show with Lilacs on funny news story. Dwayne, are you there? I used to have a producer. He shows up once in a while.
I'm here.
How many funny stories do you and Lilacs run through a week?
We do what's called the Magnificent Seven now. These are below-the-fold stories that don't get all the top-line attention.
Well, if you were paying attention, Logan's soon-to-be spouse runs the Sidebar, which is better than the Magnificent Seven, I might add, as a good student.
And you've heard both shows to be able to make that comparison.
I have, often.
I'm sure you have.
So, I want to close with a commercial for Hillsdale. Lauren, why should someone apply here?
You should apply to Hillsdale because we are a small community of people who love talking to each other, who love having difficult conversations, and who will welcome you with open arms.
Not just difficult conversations, though. Good, deep conversations.
Deep conversations, yes.
They don't have to be difficult.
They don't have to be difficult around here, but I think we tend to categorize certain topics as difficult.
And Logan, why should someone come here?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with all of that, but Hillsdale has a very unique focus on the classical liberal arts education. And like you were saying, it's not necessarily difficult because we don't believe anyone has to be an expert to understand these things. This is a truth that applies to all of humanity, you know, what our founders wrote. And no one has to be an expert. So we always welcome people in.
And this is important. Is it normal? A lot of people think Hillsdale must be these people sitting around. It's not. It's actually the most normal place I've come to in a long time. Would you affirm that for me, Logan?
Absolutely. It's
Lauren,
very normal.
Normal?
Same here. Yes.
I just want college kids to know this has got network effects, which are extraordinary for your entire career. But it's about just like every other college campus I've ever seen. So it's remarkably a wonderful place to be. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Logan. I'll be right back. America, don't go anywhere. We have a Buckeye fan showing up. Finally, some relief. I am Hugh Hewitt from Radio Free Hillsdale. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt from WRFH 101.7, Radio Free Hillsdale in Michigan. Joined by Dr. Eric Hutchinson, who is, of course, a professor of classics here, associate professor of classics, and chairman of the Collegiate Scholars Program. Before we get to what that is, you are a Buckeyes fan.
I am. That's right. Yes.
Do you have any idea who's going to be our starting quarterback?
No, I don't.
I listened to Buckeye Talk, and they've got five people in the QB room, and I have no idea if it's Devin Brown or whoever it's going to be. I've never been to a game at the Shoe. How about you?
I haven't either. The only time I've seen them was at Indiana, actually.
Well, I've gone to the Big House to see them because I went to Michigan Law School, and good news, they won. Bad news, I haven't been to the Shoe. So I'm glad that you are a Buckeye. How did that happen?
The short answer is that I was born in Michigan and grew up in Michigan, but all my family is from Ohio on both sides. So.
I can't believe you left and came up here and homesteaded reason. As I said to you during the break, I've been coming back and forth to the Hillsdale for 20 years. I've never heard of the Collegiate Scholars Program. So would you tell us what it is?
Sure. The Collegiate Scholars Program used to be called the Honors Program years ago. And that's still essentially how it functions. The Collegiate Scholars Program is an academic enrichment program for students who are interested in the kinds of things that they do in the core curriculum with great books, history, the sciences, and are interested in pursuing the kinds of questions that are raised in their readings and courses there in a more extensive way, and also in many respects, I like to think about it as really trying to get at the substance of academic inquiry without the distraction of things like grades. There is a curricular component to the program, and so there are grades that are associated with some of the things that we do, but a lot of what is, I think, most significant and important for students about the program, and for me as the person who's directing it, are the things that are the sort of intangible things that don't have anything to do with performance per se, with evaluation, you know, via the standard grading system.
How many people are in it?
At any given time, there are, I would say, around 75. You can't be in the program as a freshman, so you apply in the second semester of your freshman year. So then you would be in the program for your sophomore, junior, and senior years.
Now,
and
Scott told me he got to teach things like the Twilight Zone and Cold War America, songs of patriotism and protest, the political humor of Saturday Night Live. What are you doing there?
He also taught a class on Weird Al.
Oh, he did?
Yes,
oh,
he did.
My gosh, that's a bad class. Okay,
no, I'm sure it was great. So the way that those kinds of courses happen is that every semester the program offers 10 to 12 one-credit seminars on a variety of topics. I choose a theme for the program every year, which is any number of different things. We've done a whole year study of revolutions before. We've done the Renaissance and Renaissances. We did a whole year on humor, which is when Scott taught a class for that. He might have done both the Saturday Night Live one and the Weird Al one that year. I can't remember for certain. But about half of the courses that we offer are somehow oriented around that theme. But the other 5 to 6 are just things that people want to teach on the faculty that it may be a side interest or hobby of theirs. It may be something that they don't normally get to do in terms
of
their.
So an average enrollee will get 3 different years of 3 different themes.
Yes.
In these mini courses. So if people like to go into college administration, they like to go into athletic. If you wanted to do both of that, and you could get your athletic director to teach an hour on how to be an athletic director. I had him on yesterday. You get your dean of men on how to be the dean of men. The associate dean of men, the chief was here. You could do whatever you want depending upon your theme.
Really? Yes. I mean, yes, you could. The short answer is yes. And so I get people proposing things like Saturday Night Live or the Iliad and modern retellings of the Iliad. We had a class on the Reagan Revolution once, we had a class on Don Quixote. We had all kinds of different things it really does go in about as many different directions as.
How
as you
good
can
do you
imagine.
Have to do as a freshman to be eligible to get into this?
The application process consists of a few different components. There is a GPA requirement, which is really more of a desire. The applications are evaluated by a committee, and we do have, you know, we have some discretion about how we evaluate the various components of an application. The minimum is a 3.4. There's an essay that you write, but one of the really important parts of the application is 3 recommendations from faculty members.
Oh, bingo.
So that's
they don't
a very
write
important
those one. They don't write those easily, do they?
Well, here they sort of do in a lot of respects because there are so many great students that they're happy to, you know, the students who most of the time are interested in doing this program, they're very happy to recommend them because they've, you know, they've been outstanding in class. They seem like a great
I got to get one quick exit question in. How are classics doing? I'm so glad to have a professor of classics here.
Amazing. This is the best place in the country to teach classics. That's not a joke. This is the best place, and I think from a student perspective, one of the best places as well.
I am so glad to hear that. I want to thank you, Professor Hutchinson. Dr. Hutchinson is up here, and he's running all sorts of different things, but I'm so glad to hear that classics are thriving. Dr. Hutchinson, thank you so
much. Thank you.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt broadcasting from 101.7 WRFH, Radio Free Hillsdale today, as I did yesterday. So glad to welcome Dr. Paul Marino, who is the William and Bernice Grucock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, Dean of Social Sciences, and we're going to geek out. Now, I got to tell you something, Professor, as we speak, because we're at exactly the right time, at least 2 Supreme Court justices are listening. I'm not going to tell you who they are, but every day I've got 2 listeners, at least 2, sometimes 4, and they're not of the 3 who would normally not vote with me. They might. I don't know. I've never asked them. I don't know them. But at least 2 and maybe 4. So let's talk directly about your book, How the Court Became Supreme, The Origins of American Juristocracy. And I'm going to use that. I've never heard it before, but you denied credit for it, which I salute your humility. Where did juristocracy come from?
And, well, Americans really invented it. Article 3 of our Constitution was unprecedented. There'd never been such an independent and separate judiciary. The idea of a third branch of government was a relatively new idea. Really, Montesquieu's in the 18th century, just a generation before the founders. So there were peculiar historical circumstances in the late 18th century that made Americans confident that an independent judiciary would help liberty.
And do you agree that they were correct in their premise? And Federalist 78 was well-reasoned?
Yes, absolutely brilliant. Marshall uses it in Marbury Against Madison to defend it. And still, I think, a classic and logically irresistible statement. If you're going to have a written constitution, which was also a new thing, and that constitution is supposed to limit what the government can do on a day-to-day basis, judges have to hold the one up against the other and see whether they square with one another.
A limiting principle of the court is that they only decide the case before it, and they only go as far as they can, and they uphold a statute wherever possible. I defend the Obamacare decision by the Chief Justice for as long as it has existed. And Mark Levin thinks I'm a rhino as a result. And Mark is a very fine constitutional scholar. I've been teaching con law since 1996. What did you think of the Obamacare decision?
Well, actually, I called it, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal when I was coming. I said it's a constitutional no-brainer. The court will overturn it easily. And I was wrong. And partly that's because, and I should have known this as a historian, there's a lot of water under the bridge. Where, considering Commerce Clause cases generally, where since the New Deal, Congress has been able to regulate everything because everything is commerce.
Rickard. Yeah.
And even Justice Thomas said, I'd like to get back to the original understanding of the Commerce Clause, but there are what lawyers call reliance interests. There's too much water under the bridge.
Yes.
And I think Roberts was recognizing that. And
Now, the reliance interest did not make Roe super president. Thank God. And now it's on the front pages of every newspaper in the United States. Your appearance today, Professor, is well timed because the Arizona Supreme Court has asserted its right to interpret Arizona's law. Of course, the left is pulling their hair out. And it's actually not going to change very much in Arizona because it's already very restrictive and people can get an abortion to save the life of the mother. And I imagine the legislature may ease that up on the rape and incest exceptions, which are common. But what do you think of states taking back their role as the police power arbiters in their state?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, opponents of Roe versus Wade, that's all they wanted. In fact, it took a while after Roe versus Wade to realize how extensive the court's decision was and how completely the states had been taken away their, as you call it, the police power to regulate safety, health, welfare, and morals. And the constitutional position that, this is should be a matter that's left to the states. Republicans, since Ronald Reagan, I think, have proposed a constitutional amendment to make this national. But, that's not going to happen. So in the meantime, I think the proper constitutional view is to leave this to the states.
Now, Professor, I also argue with my friends often. I'm not sure there is a basis in the Constitution to regulate abortion on a national basis. They argue with me with a variety of ways, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, if you accept the idea that a constitutional amendment can do anything.
Well, no, I'm not doing right. within the confines of the Constitution.
And I would be opposed to, apart from things like military installations and places where the federal government does have a peculiar power.
How about the chemically induced abortion, which is an FDA? I say that's okay because it's the FDA.
Yeah, and there have been, because we went through this with alcohol before prohibition. Where states, some states were dry and some states weren't, and how could the dry states prevent people from importing liquor into them? And that's why there's an exception in Section 2 of the 21st Amendment that repealed it. So this, that is a very narrow technical point.
Now, I'm curious how you teach it. I have grown increasingly insistent that we my law students pursue a chronological understanding of the court. Otherwise, they will never understand how organically a lot of case books don't do it that way. They start with Article 3, which I think is hilarious. They don't start with 1776. They start with Article 3.
Yep.
How do you teach it?
Oh, I do. Of course, I'm a historian, so I do it very, very chronologically. And we have other courses that sort of political science people teach and sort of a con law approach where you take it topically. I definitely say how you want to understand this worked out over time.
I haven't seen your new book yet. Is it a historian's view of how the court ended up being the court? Do you begin in 1776?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I go back to antiquity. The idea of the idea of the law, the idea of having judges. In fact, I look at the Book of Judges in the Bible, and I end there too when I tell the story about the Israeli Supreme Court today, and. The first two chapters are sort of before there's a Supreme Court. trying to set up the Constitution and then set up Article 3.
Now, I believe an expansion of the court will be the end of the rule of law, because that which gets rewarded gets repeated. So if they expand the court, and I also have an argument that it might not be constitutional, although the 14th Amendment does not pass until 1868. And so the court expanded last but after 1868. And so what do you think about expanding the court?
It's a bad idea. Nine seems to be something of a magic number. Charles Evans Hughes, when Roosevelt was proposing to pack the court and expand it up to 15 in the 1930s, explained that beyond a certain number, it becomes dysfunctional. So there's a good reason why you'd want to cap it, and nine seems about right.
Would you support I don't support constitutional amendments largely because they can't pass. But there is one I might support, which is no one ought to serve beyond the age of 80 in any position in the federal government. Yeah. And therefore, Joe Biden couldn't be running again. And some members of the court would be approaching it, because 80 is really about 80 is what we're promised in the good book. But, you know, if you got 80 is what we're promised. So if you got 80, you're lucky. Yeah. But what do you think about that, letting these people hang on until the end of their ability to breathe?
I think the best thing to do would be, and historically, too, every president gets about 2 appointments per presidential term. So just have sort of staggered terms, let's say 18-year terms. A lot of states do it this way. And then instead of sort of this lottery, this crapshoot, remember what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and now liberals are calling for Sonia Sotomayor to step
down. She's not even old. She's 69. She's 1 year older than I am. Right. I'm not quitting.
Yeah. And people are choosing justices younger and younger. Trump himself said, I want the guy who's going to be there 30, 40 years. Some way of regularizing the confirmation process would be good. I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to keep the court under control, jurisdictional control in Article 3.
Yes.
And Congress almost never uses that. Impeachment was pretty much put to rest in the early 19th century. So we've settled on the idea that we're going to change the court through elections and through the confirmation process.
Can I put you on the hot spot?
Sure.
Jack Smith is, in my view, pursuing unconstitutional theories in an aggressive way that undermine the rule of law. What do you make of special counsels and of a, quote, independent department? I'm a unitary executive guy. Yeah, is no independent Department of Justice. What do you think?
Yes. And in fact, when the Independent Counsel Act expired, or when it was repealed, after Clinton.
It expired.
And yet, remember Trump talking about the Robert Mueller investigation? He seemed to have internalized this idea that, well, this guy's out of my control.
Right.
And I don't know, he might have been doing that for tactical reasons. I don't know. But yeah, the idea that part of the president's job of seeing that the laws are faithfully executed means he has to have control over the Justice Department. And there's always, inevitably, inescapably, a great deal of prosecutorial discretion. And the whole point about the unitary executive is you want to be able to hold one person accountable for this.
One more quick question. What do you make of the presidential immunity argument before the court right now on criminal matters? He has unlimited immunity for civil matters within the scope of his authority. What do you think of the it's hard.
Yeah,
it's a hard case.
I read the brief that was submitted by some historians yesterday. And I didn't read the other side's briefs. And my own partisan inclinations are with Trump. But I think here his lawyers don't have a very good argument.
But how do you limit that? Otherwise, you have every prosecutor in the country harassing the president.
Right.
Even if you've got a good case against Trump, and I don't think they do, but even if you did, how would you limit it?
Yeah, and the civil case in New York especially, which law, I don't understand, civil fraud. But this is really worse than a criminal penalty. So I think out of control, independent prosecutors at the state level as well is another big problem, where states have independently elected attorneys general. And, that's also a unitary executive problem.
Professor Paul Marino, the author of How the Court Became Supreme. I look forward to reading it. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you. Always great to be on the show.
I'll be right back. America, don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I am joined by Dr. Dan Copeland. He is Dean of the Masters in Classical Education. He's a professor of education, and he owns the hole in the ground. And so let's talk about the hole in the ground and what is going to rise from it, because it's by the way, it's got the best piece of turf on the campus, because it's in front of Christ Chapel, which is the equal of any chapel I've been in the United States. Tell me about the hole in the ground and what it will be.
Yeah, so we developed, you know, this graduate program of classical education, and you know, it started 2 years ago. So we have, you know, two cohorts going through it. And, you know, part of the commitment that the college has to classical education is that it wanted to have a place on campus. And I think it's a wonderful statement, you know, by the college that it is right there on the quad, as you say, right close to Christ Chapel, you know, Central Hall, the Student Union, right across from the Student Union. And that's going to be kind of the headquarters of our operation here at Hillsdale College to train classical educators, you know, for America, not just for the schools that we're helping to open. You know, Dr. Katie O'Toole leads that effort in the K-12 office. But we have a plan to provide leadership for schools well beyond even our schools. So that's going to be our central hub. We have a residential program, so people come here and they move here for 2 years. So we want to have a place where they can take courses, they can interact with one another, and they can learn about this great tradition that they're a part of.
I am not going to throw shade on masters in education because my son has one. He's a naval officer. He learned some things, was 1 year, 1.5 years, but he didn't learn a lot. He didn't learn enough. What do you think about current masters in education, and how will the masters in classical education be different?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you're exactly right. The tradition or the understanding of higher ed education programs, the reputation's not good. In fact, here at Hillsdale, we don't have a major in education. We have a minor in classical education, but we want our undergrads to pursue a major in a particular field. But at the graduate level, and again, if undergraduate studies has a bad reputation, graduate studies in education perhaps is worse. And it's pretty much a way that teachers can earn a raise, right?
It's accreditation to earn a raise.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of DEI, a lot of
absolutely.
CRT.
Yeah.
So, about half of his classes were nonsense.
Right, absolutely. And I understand that completely. What's different about our program is we're trying to recapture a tradition in education. And so our students, you know, don't take courses in how to create a bulletin board, how to do a PowerPoint presentation. They take courses in history, philosophy, humane letters, because we think what really matters in the formation of a classical educator is that person be a good human being, well-grounded in that tradition. So I would put our program up against any education program in the country, and you'll see that it's radically different.
I want to go to your school. I don't think I can come up here for 2 years. It's residential, but I want to go to your school. Is there a designed curriculum that they will follow? Is there actually, everyone's going to have the same experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the features of the program is that we have a cohort model. What that means is everyone comes in at the same time. We only have students come in the fall, and they take all of their first year classes together as a cohort. And it's a prescribed curriculum. There's no choice in the curriculum whatsoever in that first year. Again, history, philosophy, humane letters. In the second year, we have required classes that we want all students to take, more practical classes like classical pedagogy, school culture, those kinds of things. But we also offer elective options as well, where students can, if they want to go into administration, for example, we have a class in classical school administration, how to run a school, how to develop a facility plan, how to lay out a budget. So it is a residential program. The people who come here are committing for 2 years. But one of the great blessings we have is that people believe in what we're doing here, and they've contributed to the program. And so all of our residential students come here completely tuition free.
Wow.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I'll even go beyond that. Every admitted student to the residential program not only completes the entire 2 years tuition free, but we give them a small, it's not a large amount, a small living stipend to help offset their living expenses.
Hot dogs and mac and cheese.
Well, that's up to them. Right.
So tell me something. I have a wild idea, which is before I would hire a superintendent, I would make them come here and take the 2 years. Because if you're going to run every teacher in a district, to have this background would be a very valuable thing. Have you had any soups come through yet, or deputy soups who want to rise up and want their school district to which they aspire to leave, often at very high salary?
Yeah. So what we look for in our candidates is the potential to lead. So we we would be glad to welcome in people who were, you know, at district level, superintendents, all of that. But primarily the students coming in, we look at their applications and we look at a track record of leadership. It could be in education. It could be in their undergraduate experience. It could have been, you know, they were teaching in a school and they were a lead teacher, but they have this kind of propensity or this desire to lead. And so we're willing to work with current leaders, absolutely, but we're investing in the future. We're looking for those people who hold potential, because it's a huge commitment on our behalf to say, we're going to give you this graduate degree completely free. So we ask them to look forward and to realize that with this degree, they have an obligation to go forth and lead.
You know, your applications are going to go through the roof with people who are 2 years fully free. How many people applied last year?
Yeah, so that's a difficult thing to answer, to give a specific number, because our application has so many parts to it. But we had about 200 people begin the application. We can only take a maximum of 20 people. But I need to give you a heads up. On the horizon, June 2025, we're actually going to be launching what we call a hybrid program, because we realize that not everyone can come here and spend 2 years, although it's a great place to be, and it's a great place to study. Not all these educators can come here to Hillsdale and study for 2 years, so we're going to go to them. So we've created this hybrid program where our students will come to campus during the summertime, take a boot camp experience, be on campus, interact with, academic enrichment, or a faculty here, but then they'll return to their schools where they will continue to take courses online. It'll be a 3-year program, but it'll be actually based on the residential program that we already have up and running.
Now, the school and the building is named for Diana Davis Spencer. What did you have a hand in the design of the building? I know architects get the final say, but did you tell them you had some ideas in mind?
Yeah. So one of the great things about Hillsdale is we're really good about bringing people together in a room and having a conversation. So I was one of those people who was invited to be in the room. And so, here at Hillsdale, especially in the classroom, we believe in the art of the conversation. And so one of the things that I was able to contribute to the conversation is that we need to have classrooms where we can all look at each other, we can engage with each other in meaningful conversations.
How many cohorts will be in that building at any time?
Yeah, so it's a 2-year program. We have one cohort per year coming in. So,
40 students.
Yeah. It would be a maximum of 40. But with the hybrid program, what that allows us to do is to do as many cohorts as we're able to find faculty.
Will
to
they
teach
be
them.
Cohorts as well in the at distance?
Yeah, absolutely. So we kind of believed in the cohort model in the ideal, but now we have 2 years of experience, and the benefits of that experience have proven that it's well worth our time to do that.
You have so many gifted teachers at Hillsdale.
Indeed.
How many of them will be teaching in the graduate program who are presently teaching in the undergraduate college?
Yeah, so we have about 6 faculty in the education department who teach at the undergraduate and the graduate level. As our programs expand, we're slowly hiring more people. But as you know very well, the quality of the program depends on the people you can find to teach them. So we're highly selective about who we hire here at the college and in the graduate school in particular.
Explode a myth for me, please. People think it's a conservative right-wing place. It's not. It is actually a liberal, small L, liberal place. You're not going to be indoctrinated. You're going to learn.
Yeah. So our students come here to read old books, right? Yeah. We're trying to introduce them to a long tradition of liberal learning. And that's what they're going to experience in the Graduate School of Classical Education.
So they're going to have Jeremy Bentham, and they're going to have John Stuart Mill. They're going to have Jefferson, and they're going to have Hamilton. They're going to have both sides of every issue. They're going to read women, men of all ages. They're going to read everything and talk about it seriously.
Absolutely. We have our students read John Dewey, right? Even, we want them to know, we want them to experience John Dewey, experience his words, and not just have this caricature of who he is, and that's across the spectrum. So,
well, Dr. Arnn is teaching Orwell right now. Yeah, Orwell is no conservative, right? Right, exactly. He's not a conservative. It's like Hitch was on my show every week when he was alive. He's not a conservative. He's right. A liberal, a classical liberal.
Right, 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 right. So we here at Hillsdale College are committed to the liberal arts tradition, and that means to read widely on a wide variety of topics.
Now, when they finish, they have to go find a job.
Absolutely.
Will it help? Will it hurt to have this master's?
Well, our reputation as an institution has been quite good. Every year we have a classical school job fair. The first year we opened it up, we had 14 schools. Within just a couple of years, we had around 60 schools that were applying. Last year, we had 200 schools apply to come to our job fair, and we had to turn away 140 of them. So, yes, wow. Our teachers are in high demand, and that's without any teacher certification whatsoever. We just help cultivate broadly educated, good human beings, and our graduates are in high demand.
You know, Dean Copeland, I have friends who go in to Teach for America.
Yeah.
I have friends who go to KIPP.
Yeah.
They get thrown into the deep end. They get thrown into the worst schools in America, and some of them flourish, some of them down. How do you prepare people to actually teach? You know, the masters of education are out there getting all huffy about how they learn how to teach.
Yeah.
I said, no, actually, that's not how you learn how to teach, but how do you suggest that they master the craft?
Yeah, so classical education requires that the person at the front of the room, the educator, be a good human being. That's our primary goal. So that's why we offer them lenses on education like philosophy, history, humane letters. That said, there is an art. There is a craft to teaching. And yes, you learn a lot of it on the job, but we also give our students and our graduates, you know, elements of teaching, how to lead a class, how to pose a question, how to lead a discussion, all of that kind of a thing. So we pay attention to that, but that's not our primary goal. Our primary goal is the cultivation of the human being.
Dean Copeland, how do people find it in 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, classicalgrad.hillsdale.edu.
Classicalgrad.hillsdale.edu. Dean, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
I'll be right back with Dr. Arnn, the man behind the curtain. Not so much then, often behind the curtain, but sometimes in front of it. I'm with me next. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's my last segment from Hillsdale with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. Dr. Arnn, I have two things to cover with you, and then I'll turn it over for you to brag a little bit. First thing, I come back to my room last night after the teletown hall, and I have a message from William Broadbeck. It's the nicest message I've received forever.
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't have to do that. You are blessed that Jen and Bill were on or are on your sport team, your board, your chairman emeritus. You didn't have to do that. That's a generous and kind heart.
Well, that's his way. He's the guy who hired me here.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Got a call from him. Thought it was the dumbest idea in the world to go to work in a college. And if he hadn't been the man he is, that's one of the reasons why I decided it wasn't so dumb.
Now, number one. Number two, I want to put some pictures up on the screen, Harley. I walked into Christ Chapel yesterday with Mr. Stanish, and that's the entrance, and then rolled through him, and I am stunned that this place is here. It is the equal of any sanctuary anywhere I have been in the world. St. Peter's is large, and this is small, but this is intimate, and this is grace-filled, and the organist was teaching a lesson up there. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. It's we're very proud of it, of course. The Lord gave it to us. When I came here in 2000, first 6 months, we made a plan for the campus. It had a chapel in it. And chapels are expensive, and I'm a tightwad, and so we started building it in 2017. It took 17 years. And then it took 2 years to build it. And it's changes things around here. Makes our what we are plain. Christianity was in a slightly ambiguous position when I came here. It's not anymore. We're for freedom of religion. 180 years old. We never required a faith statement to attend, but the articles say the teaching of the Christian faith by precept and example shall remain a conspicuous aim of the college. And so we do that. And everybody knows that. just almost everybody here is a Christian. We have some Jews. We're going to get some Hindus. I've been to India. We're getting some, getting people from Africa now lately, too. They're mostly Christians. But the point is you have to respect the purposes of the college to be a member of the community. And the chapel makes plain an important part of those purposes.
Now, I picked a rando student, Mr. Standish. I said, hey, you, I got to get over there. And you got the construction site in the middle, so I couldn't get in. So Mr. Standish not only took me in, he took me around, and he explained everything in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not, he is himself going to be a teacher and himself wants to be a minister of children. But he wants to, he showed me all the symbology, things you wouldn't catch unless you were walking around with a warden. Yeah. And he was just a random student, right? Just a random student.
Well, one of the things about any organization, if it's healthy, is that everybody knows all about it. I once had accreditors. And I've been through two, and they've both been great, but they're worrisome bureaucracy. Anyway, one of them said to me, I've never seen several things before. And what? She said, I ask everybody what the mission is, and they know. And I said, and they say the same thing. And she said, how'd you do that? And I said, I didn't do it. And she said, how does it happen? And I said, well, if you manage the organization toward its mission, that's the currency of reasoning for everything we do. So they all learn about it.
Now, we were in a building last night, the Sajak Center, I believe, and for the wonderful Pat Sajak. And we had the nice place where you record podcasts and things like that. It looked all very academic. The set on the other side is the gloomiest thing I've ever seen because it's the totalitarian set.
Yeah.
So you built a little totalitarian set. Why? Tell them why. I know why, but tell them why.
Well, we do these online courses, and we try to do them well. And I'm teaching one right now on a course that I teach called Totalitarian Novels. And it's a little grim. And so they wanted to make the set look like a formerly beautiful and civilized place that was in decay. And so footprints in the dust are part of the set. And if you like movies, watch the great 1930s sometime, Great Expectation, because it looks like Mrs. Havisham's house.
Oh, yes, you're right.
It does. Yeah.
But what's wonderful, they're not all grim. The ending of That Hideous Strength. Do you teach that last?
Yeah,
because it ends on a very high note.
Yeah, we're doing that today.
And, are you doing that today?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you make them work to the end? I mean, they want to go right to the end, right? They want to go to the end when the couple is reunited.
Yeah, the way we're doing this one, it's thought to be good. Is they you know, kids around here are smart and they work really hard, and so we picked four students from my class that I'm teaching, a real class, and they're in the course with me, and so they've had to read all the books. And they've still got to do the work in the course, too. And they're getting the same amount of credit as everybody else, but they're spending hours and hours at this.
When does that air?
It'll be a couple of months, probably. It'll be announced. They're going to produce it now, and that's a big palaver.
It could easily be a month on the Hugh Hewitt Show and the Hilltale Dialogue, because I think you're doing Darkness at Noon, you're doing 1984, you're doing Brave New World, and you're doing That Hideous Strength.
Right.
I got the curriculum down.
That's right.
I've got this down after 2 days. Thank you for hosting me. It's been fabulous.
Thank you for coming. Great to have you here.
And if people want to contribute to Hillsdale and the mission, hillsdale.edu. Its mission's much bigger than the college. It's the country. It's the nation. It's the West. Hillsdale.edu. Thank you, Dr. Arne. Mm-hmm. I'll be back tomorrow from the studios inside the Beltway. I have to go from where it is happy and light in spring, where it is dark and dreary and political. I will make it there, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you, Dwayne. Thank you, Harley. Scott, thank you so much for everything that you've done and to all of your students. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Talk to you tomorrow.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.